know that there has had to have been some sacrifice, whether it's time or nutrition or whatever it is.
I'm recording myself talking about having a relationship with my chest.
I'm Ben Cunning.
I'm Dave Kennedy.
And this is Hacking Health Podcast.
Yo, welcome back. We are episode 140, so Dave doesn't give me a hard time. I've done my one and only job of knowing what episode we are.
Yeah, last podcast, you didn't even know what number we were. That's like literally the only job you had.
Literally the only job that I have.
Yeah.
And we're joined again with Lise Forte. We were just discussing the last episode you were on was episode 27, which was not today or yesterday. So today we're going to catch up and discuss all the things that we haven't achieved in the past 2 years. Welcome.
We were just discussing, we haven't achieved, Lisa still hasn't had pineapple on pizza yet, and I have not been mountain climbing and with freezing weathers yet either, so.
And we do have the evidence of both of those things being discussed. It's just many, many, many episodes ago.
Yeah.
So what, so I mean, apart from that, what's been going on?
I've been doing a lot of climbing. I went to the Andes and did a load of really high altitude stuff, which was interesting. Actually, there's a lot of stuff that I think is quite interesting from a training perspective to touch on about that, because like it's about like that hypoxic state that your body's in and what that feels like, which was miserable. But also, if you're a masochist, it's great. But if you're not, it's not. So I then made the mistake of thinking that I could go to Mongolia in the winter to go ice climbing. And I hadn't Googled Mongolia in the winter before I booked everything and paid for everything, every element of the trip. And then I looked up and it's like, oh, it's minus 45 degrees centigrade in Mongolia in the winter. And I'm living in a yurt. So that was an interesting few weeks. I'm not going to lie. That was
a good mindset challenge, if we take some perspective from it.
Don't go to Mongolia in the winter would be my main takeaway from that experience. So you said
minus 45 centigrade?
Mm-hmm.
Hold on.
Quick. I gotta go with that. That's minus 49. That's pretty cold. That's like a regular
day in Ohio in the winter?
No. That's not, we get to like minus 10. Maybe 12 in Ohio, not minus 47. That's insane.
And no heating because you're in a yurt. So
I'm good.
Did you have fun?
No.
Okay. So we'll park that one. Have you done anything that's fun?
I went ice climbing in China. Now that was cool. So what we did was we decided we were going to go and explore China and see what ice climbing, what frozen waterfalls existed in China to go climb. And Westerners don't really go and travel around China. Like that's not a thing that's often really done. So we sort of got satellite images of the area and kind of worked out where the waterfalls would be. And then we were like, well, you know, I'm not really sure if we're just allowed to walk around with ice axes in China. It's like, I'm not sure how cool that is. Turns out it's chill. They're completely fine with it. So we went and we got a train from Beijing into the middle of nowhere China, to the point where they hadn't seen blonde white women ever. So when I was in a supermarket, they were like, I need a photograph of you. You're so wound. Let me take a photo of you. So that was awkward. And we had a drone and we kind of hiked and we found these frozen waterfalls that had basically been unclimbed and unexplored, really, and just went and climbed. And it was amazing.
So a proper adventure, not like a book your adventure and just go with everybody else. Like this is literally something that
we rented a car and we were like, I guess you can park it here. I don't know. Like, I'm guessing you don't get arrested. We'll just see what happens. We're like, can we fly the drone? I guess so. I don't know. So yeah, it was kind of very much like find out and see in China, which is high risk, high reward.
Okay. So Mongolia, no. China, yes.
Yeah. And the food's really epic in China. So if you do have to go to China, yeah.
Okay, good.
I've been to China a few times and I have not been a fan of Chinese food. Like I love Chinese food in America. I do not like Chinese food in China.
The American Chinese food.
is very different.
People say that about a lot. Like, Japan is the same, and so is Korea. Like, Korean food in the UK and the US is one thing. Korean food in Korea is a very different animal entirely. Like, you don't, if they say, oh, this dish is really spicy and you're in Korea, do not order that dish. You are not man enough to take on that that meal, I can assure you.
Well, it's funny, they have, you know, like Thai spice, you know, so you have like American spice. They're like, oh, you can do like a 1 to 5, or you can do like a 5 to 10 in Thai spice. And it's an insane level of heat that they put into there. Yeah. And there was a time where one of our sales folks, Ryan, had asked me to go get him some Thai food next door. This place, I can't remember the name of the place offhand. It'll come to me in a second. But I go and I ordered Thai spicy 10 for him while he was on a sales call. And they're like, no, they said no to me. Like, they're like, no, it's fine. So like, are you sure you want Thai 10? Like, I'm just confirming again, you're saying Thai 10. I'm like, yes. So they actually put like warning labels on it, like saying this is extremely spicy, spicy 10, spicy 10. And I didn't want Ryan to know when he ate it. So I got another to-go bin. Then I had to move the food to this to-go bin. So it didn't have the warning labels on it. And then Ryan ate it and he started hiccuping right away as he started to do it. And he's so like won't lose a bet type of person. It's kind of folks you want on your team, on the sales team, right? That he ate the whole thing as he's dying. And wouldn't give me any reaction whatsoever. I mean, he's dripping in sweat. He's fully red. It's burning him. It's killing him. But he's not going to give me the satisfaction to know that I wrecked him. So, yeah, it was good times. But definitely don't order Thai Spicy 10.
And be cautious with who's ordering your next meal. That's the lesson we take from that.
He's got to be careful. Yeah, you got to test it ahead of time. Yeah, I can handle, actually. We did, like, the One Chip Challenge and, like, you know, Jaloki Ghost Peppers and Trinidad Scorpions. I can handle all those, actually, fairly decently. I do well on spice. It's just, as I've gotten older, I've noticed I can't tolerate it later on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, like, I'm pretty messed up for a while. So, yeah, I stopped doing the stupid, you know, Trinidad Scorpions and things like that because I can't handle it anymore. But, yeah.
Right. So let's talk about the training aspect before we go down a rabbit hole of talking about spicy food and the bathroom. So what? Like, what goes into the training for whenever you go on a trip or an adventure like that?
I'm planning a big trip this summer, which is back at altitude. And I think the thing that's really challenging about performing at altitude is the low amount of oxygen that you're exposed to, right? So one of the things that I always bring like a pulse oximeter with me so that I can monitor my oxygen saturation level and my heart rate, which tells me a lot of data points about how well I'm acclimatizing on the mountain. And when you get to like your high point on a mountain, one of the last mountains I climbed that was really high, we were about 6,000 meters, which my maths is not going to be good enough to convert this into American. What is it going to be in American? 6,000 meters? I think
like 18,000 something. Hold on. We're just going to need to have a permanent converter.
We're going to have
6,000 meters.
If y'all could just standardize on to America, that'd be great.
19,000 feet. 19,500 feet.
So I was about there, and my heart rate lying flat in my sleeping bag was about 186 BPM.
Holy
shit.
So
you're doing like you're doing a HIIT workout basically at that point. So your like caloric burn is enormous because you're at 186 BPM. And then on top of that, you got to get out of your tent and start climbing. And the summit day on a big mountain, it's probably 9 hours of climbing to the summit, probably another 8 or so hours down, plus a bit more. So you're easily knocking at like 12, 15 hour days on that summit day. So it's really, really difficult to train for because you can't put that kind of level of intensity into the endurance. One thing that I'm focusing on a lot this time is VO2 max training, which if you haven't done it, it's the worst thing ever in the history of mankind. You think HIIT training and Tabata interval training is bad, this is way worse, like significantly worse. I have vomited almost consistently actually afterwards. It's horrendous. So I've been doing that, and I've just been doing lots of variety, lots and lots of squats, and lots of weight, especially for the leg stuff. And then lots of cardio. But it's really difficult to train for because, like I said, you're in an environment where you're going to have had no sleep. You can't digest food at altitude, so you're not really eating. You're doing day after day after day. So a big mountain in the Andes is probably 5-6 days of climbing. And you're in an oxygen deprived environment, so things like cuts don't heal anymore, things like that. And then you're going, okay, now you need to perform, and now you need to do an ultra endurance event, and then you're expecting your body to be like, yay, this is great. So it's a bit of a nightmare sport, if I'm honest. Not to mention, if you mess up, you actually die. So it's like
there's that component. Yeah, just a small little,
back to
little
high risk high reward.
Risk high reward girl, what can I say?
I've actually had a little bit, not anywhere in comparison to that, but I did some oxygen deprivation training with Diamond Dallas Page, and he has these oxygen bags, and you have like a mask on basically, and it simulates, you know, being at like 20,000 feet elevation and whatnot. And again, no comparison, but I was on a bike, and you knock off your oxygen, and he's like, go, and you just crank as hard as you can go. And I've never, like, I do HIIT training twice a week. I love it. I was basically vomiting at that point, you know, as it was going. And I was only doing it for like 15 minutes, you know, like not days or whatever. And then he hits you with a, you know, a bunch of oxygen, you know, afterwards. And you're like, oh, hey, I feel great now. And then all of a sudden he's like, okay, go again. And you're like, oh my God, I'm going to throw up again. Oh, okay, I'm okay now. It's like, it's the weirdest emotional train wreck that I've ever been on working out. I'm like, I don't know what's going on. Am I dying? Am I okay? Like, you know, but I couldn't imagine, obviously, the mountain climbing portion of it, but also just for the short period of time that I did it, I was exhausted. It was like times 30 the amount of effort that it took to actually go and do it, which I thought was pretty crazy.
Yeah, and that's the thing that people don't realize. So when you see the people trudging up Everest or wherever, whatever mountain, like just putting one foot in front of the other is agony. It's the most intense workout you've ever done in your life. And then the worst thing for me is when you get there, gets sort of just below the summit, and there's like 200 meters, 100 meters maybe of climbing. And you're at base camp, you're sort of like, this is fine. Like I can climb 100 meters of ice with my ice tools. It's not a problem. At sea level, not a problem. When you're at 6,500 meters or wherever you are, you're like, I'm actually afraid I won't die. I'm actually afraid I might survive this and have to carry on. That's my biggest concern.
And the benefits of, I'm in so much like agony, I just want to die right now versus like, if I do have to survive this, what happens? So,
Exactly.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I actually met somebody the other day who introduced me to the concept of German volume training.
Yes.
Well, that's a fan horror show.
I say a fan favorite, but not fan favorite. I mean, I would rather do that than have to climb at 6,000 meters if I'm
willing. So, yeah.
What's the science behind German volume training?
Can I say that the Germans are a little bit fucked up in the head? Am I allowed to say that? Because it's my podcast, I can't say that. Essentially, it's obviously the volume side of it. So to program it properly, you do 10, generally a compound exercise, 10 sets of 10 with a very strict 60-second rest period. From my experience, you get, obviously you have to start quite low in terms of the weight that you do, but you get quite strong quite quickly. I think we saw pretty significant growth, Dave, whenever we did German volume training. And if I'm programming it, I don't do like an 8-week just German volume training. I'll program like German volume sets. So like if it's like squats or deadlifts or whatever it is, it's not like a full workout because I actually like my clients and want them to stay for longer than just that one period. So if anybody gets an extended period of German volume training, get the message. But yeah, so it's good for building strength. It's good for obviously building the endurance side. And then obviously it's good for building the muscle size side as well.
Yeah. What sort of percentage of your one rep max are you doing for that when you program it?
I would say starting probably 50 to 60. With the goal, like you want to sort of have it that you're starting to feel on like rep 7, 8, 9, 10 from set 7, 8, 9, 10.
Okay,
if
yeah,
that makes
yeah.
sense. And the goal is to get to the end and be able to do the 10 sets of 10. And then that's whenever you up the weight. So if you start at 60% and you get 65% whenever you get the 10 sets of 10. But for me, that's, again, it's the mental side of, like, you know, doing the first rep and going, okay, only 99 to go.
Yeah, exactly. I guess that's quite good for the mountaineering type stuff as well, because that's the sort of mindset that you've got to employ. Like, you've got to get through it. So,
yeah.
I think variety is key, though. One thing I found in my training, so I don't know about you guys, but if I do something new, if I do a new exercise, I'll get really bad DOMS the next day. And then if I do that exercise again a couple of days later, I won't get any DOMS at all, ever again. No matter how much I increase the rate, no matter how hard I go, that's it. I don't ever get any muscle soreness at all after that. And so what I realized was that I plateau a lot faster if I stick with one set of exercises for a block of even like 6 or 7 weeks. So I have to change it up quite a lot to see development. Do you guys see that as well?
For me, any change in stimulus, if I did a leg extension at the gym that I train at, and then I did a leg extension at a different gym, like, I will feel the difference in that straight away. But then my body will adapt pretty quickly. But just that one change in stimulus, even to the point of, if I change my training block and I do similar exercises in a different order, like, my body will recognize that. But yeah, after a couple of weeks, it sort of starts to normalize.
Annoying.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me, any type of difference.
Like, I mean, like, even if you like take a few weeks off, you know, and start lifting again, you're going to have that issue, right? And it's just training your muscles in a different way. The volume is going to definitely cause, you know, some pretty substantial differences in how you feel, as well as, you know, soreness, just general recovery. I know when I did GVT, I gained some pretty substantial size mass with it pretty quickly because of the amount of volume that I was really pushing through my legs. But I got very tired of it very quickly.
I actually had a client request it for that reason of, like, not having to swap things around and, like, not have to change loads of weights around. And I was like, are you sure? And he was like, yeah. And I'm like, okay. And then he did. It was absolutely fine. But yeah, for me, whenever it comes to soreness in general, like, yes, that initial sort of change in whatever the stimulus is will be brutal. And that's like where you can't stand up or sit down or go down the stairs or do anything. But for me, after that, like, how I sort of judge it is, if I'm stood here and I've trained legs yesterday, if I go to pick something up, I'll feel it. But like, just standing day to day, I should generally be okay. Like, I'm not looking to be debilitated at all times because of training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's the key.
Yeah, yeah. I have a question on the, just specifically because I've just programmed for a client who is climbing Mount Kilimanjaro.
Oh, yeah. I did that for my 21st October, birthday. Right. I'm not going to tell you how long ago that was. 1 year ago.
Last year, two years ago? Yeah. what consideration, like, I've gone into it and I've done the program and we have two blocks until he actually does the climb. My focus this time round was focusing on core strength and upper body strength and endurance more for lower body. From your experience, what other considerations should I give in his training, and also any advice? Hopefully he will listen to this. Any advice that you would give to him?
So Killy is a walk, essentially. It's a hike. It's a very difficult hike. So when people say it's a walk, those are people who have not climbed Kilimanjaro, because nothing at that altitude is a walk. But anyway, that aside, I would say calves are so important. Calves are so, so, so important, because on the way up, it will feel like you just want to cut them out with a knife because they're in agony. Like, it's horrifying. So I'd say calves are really important. And actually, I found that in the walk into the climbs I do, which are usually pretty steep at altitude, if I've done a lot of back squats and a lot of back squats, heavy, heavy weight, I'm so much better at doing step ups onto rocks, stepping down off of things, all of that kind of stuff. There's a lot more stability in my leg and in my knee, which really, really helps. And I think strong quads, strong glutes are really important, because if you're carrying a rucksack, you're really carrying it on your hips and therefore on your glutes and on your quads. So I definitely say that. And then I think it's about, like, tendon strength. So, like, getting out and walking on uneven terrain, because it takes so much time for those tendons, in comparison to the big muscles like your quads or your glutes. It takes a lot more time for those tendons to strengthen. And so I'd say, yeah, just like, it's volume, volume, volume for sure, because what you're going to be doing, you have to be able to do day after day after day. It's not a one day event. So if you're going out and you're doing a 6 hour hike and you can't get up the next morning and do another 6 hour hike, you're not ready.
Yeah. Where I did, I mean, with a reverse program, upper body stuff was like general rep ranges. And then I was like given, you know, sets of 25 each leg, sets of 30 each leg, and I'll ramp that up the closer we get. Did a lot of like unilateral stuff. So like split squats, box step ups and things like that, because I thought it'd be good. Did a bit of research into it on, yes, calves, but also like tibialis anterior. So what I would call your front calf, because I think, yes, going up, you would get your calves, but going down is any like, low grade hike that I've done on the way down, I'm feeling it in my front calf. So there are the considerations that I took into that as well. But he's given me the, like, we'll have all his kit in, we'll do Stairmaster closer to the time, and like just absolutely send it in terms of like trying to get used to walking with all of the stuff as well, because obviously doing it with just your body and then doing it with the pack and, you know, all the climbing gear.
And
is much
I would say my last recommendation is train with a heavier pack than you're going to have, because at altitude, 1 kilo is 5 kilos. So if you're training with the exact weight, you're going to really struggle.
And try and lose as many kilos as possible between now and then.
Yes and no. I mean, it's difficult. You'll lose a lot of weight. There's no way around it. I mean, for example, when I was in the Andes, one of the biggest issues I have actually is weight loss. Because if I'm doing a couple of mountains and I'm in the mountain for 6 days, I'll lose pretty close to 10 kilos. Oh, God, Dave again is here.
22 pints. It's okay, I can do that one. 22 pints. I knew that one straight away.
The American translation can just pop up. Yeah, so you'll lose easily that.
I figured Riverside would have some AI integration to change out like UK speak to.
But I just need to put that on. Can you translate this UK to US, please?
Yeah, exactly.
So like, it actually like changes like Lisa's face and wording expression, so she's still, like. Like 12 kilos, it actually says like 22 pounds or whatever, you know.
So in preparation for that, like, do you actively try and like eat more coming up to that?
Yeah, but it's hard because you're training really hard. So typically, so when I was in the Andes last year, I was based in Huaraz, which is the main town in the Andes. It's about 3,200 meters of altitude. And you kind of go up, you do 6 days of climbing on a mountain, you come back to Huaraz. And the key in Huaraz is you've got to try and eat as much food as possible before the next trip. But the problem is, when you're looking at how many calories you're burning in a day, you're looking at like 40, 50 plus thousand sometimes. Like, the amount is absolutely enormous. So your calorie deficit is sitting at like this ridiculous amount. And then you're coming back and you're just like, even if I literally just eat pizza after pizza with no break, I can't make this up in a week.
With pineapple and
There's
ham,
no point
of
in
course.
That, though, is there? So. Because you'll vomit it up. So then that's counterproductive, Dave. So why would you do that? Okay. Plus, the Peruvians, they have some taste. They don't partake in that.
You'll not be able to get that.
They're classy folk.
So there, like, essentially there is the way to make it up, like you lose weight. And
yeah, you'll lose a lot of weight. And the downside is you lose a lot of muscle as well, because at altitude it's easier to burn muscle than it is to burn fat. So
that's Dave out. You can absolutely guarantee Dave is never going to do anything at altitude ever again for that specific reason.
Yeah, no, you gain muscle, Dave. There's loads of muscle up there that you gain.
okay. If there's some studies that show I gain like more muscle than not, then
you
I might
be considering this. You should see the Mongolians in the winter. They are ripped. You should go there.
I will say, though, like, even we did the Colorado event last May, like, even being at that altitude, like, everything was just infinitely more difficult. And I think it's, I don't know what it was up there in terms of altitude, but it was, let me find out.
Can you do it in feet,
no,
by the way?
Don't understand that in Europe.
It's like learning a different language.
It'd just be easier if the Americans came on board with the European system, but we won't get into that.
So it's only 2,000 meters, which is 6,800 feet.
Which is like one third of what Lisa was at?
Yeah. And it was difficult then.
Yeah. I even noticed in like Denver, Colorado at the airport, like when I have to sprint from like gate to gate, I'm almost dead. So I can't imagine, like, it's probably like 3,000 feet.
That's all of the altitude training Dave's done. He's running.
Yeah, not it. Denver airport. Not after that. That's right. Then cold plunges, I'm out. So, you know.
So, right. So the food side, the training side. Well, I mean, what do you do then? Like, do you have to train differently for different climbs, or is it just like the variety all the time?
It depends, really. If I'm going ice climbing in China, I don't need as much leg strength. I need a lot more upper body strength because it's going to be a lot more vertical ice climbing. If I'm going up a mountain, it will be less vertical. So my upper body strength isn't as important. And in fact, actually, the problem that you have is if you don't need a load of upper body strength, the more bulk you have, the harder you're going to make it, because it's muscle that you're not really utilizing, but is adding a ton of weight into the process. So it's about it's quite difficult to keep that sort of weight to muscle power ratio right. You can quite easily gain a lot of muscle and then become too heavy. And so it's a very difficult balance between keeping your weight down, but your strength up. And that's quite challenging. I think in the more vertical stuff, which I really like, hanging off my ice axes off something that looks absolutely horrendous in the middle of nowhere, where you're like, I don't know what happens if I fall. Like, I doubt there's a Chinese rescue service that comes out. Like, I don't know what happens. That's just awesome, because you get like fully pumped. You're like climbing this massive thing. You can't bail out. Ice climbing is one of these types of climbing that is known as no fall climbing, because essentially you can't protect it. So if you fall, I mean, you're falling all the way down to the ground, and, you know, human bodies don't deal too well with that kind of rapid deceleration. So it's one of those sorts of things where you've got to kind of, it's quite interesting, because you've got to keep it at a level where you don't start to burn out. So it's like, if I was to say to you with your deadlifts, how long could you keep deadlifting, at what rate, weight, and at what pace could you do that before you'd start blowing up? And you can't get to a point where you're fatiguing and you're getting too pumped. It's quite a difficult challenge.
Yeah. I mean, Dave's a deadlift king, so what are you, Dave? How long could you deadlift for?
I mean, like, consistently, like to keep going?
Like, if you had to do it nonstop for 40 minutes, what kind of pace and weight would you need to be able to do that? No breaks.
And with no breaks? Oh, God. Like, I don't know. Like, maybe, like, 45s on each side?
I'm just going to change Dave's program now to deadlifts. 40 minutes, continuous reps.
Yeah.
Can we live stream it?
I'm looking for a new trainer, everybody. If anybody knows a new trainer, please let me know. You know, this is a pretty good run, but I do love deadlifts. I don't love deadlifts to do 45 minutes worth of deadlifts. So, but I mean, honestly, like the continual stuff actually is pretty good. I do a lot of that, like in like HIIT training, for example, where I'll do a lot, not 40 minutes, but I'll do more so like, you know, they'll have like blocks where you do a combination of like, you know, tread, rower, and then kind of the gym. And the gym's more, you know, continual weightlifting. So you're never really stopping. You don't get breaks. So it might be like going from like burpees to like shoulder presses to, you know, chest presses and things like that. But you're all doing it kind of in a circuit. And I do enjoy those. And I think there's definitely a lot of good, one, obviously the cardiovascular benefits, I think of that is great. But also, you know, you're loading up a ton of volume at that point as well. So and you're not really fatiguing the muscle pretty substantially. You're not destroying the muscle, like lifting heavy and things like that. So I definitely think there's a lot of benefits.
I had a great revelation. I had to go to the hospital for something else the other day, and they did like the pulse and everything tests on me. And my resting heart rate is 47 BPM with like an SpO2 of 100, which I was like, oh, if I achieve nothing else.
Athlete. So whenever you're standing, whenever you're about to do it, so generally a climb, is it 40 minutes or it depends obviously on the height?
It depends on a lot of things, really. I would say, like, generally speaking, yeah, you're probably looking at like climbing an ice fall, like a frozen waterfall. It's probably going to take you 45 minutes, 50 minutes maybe to climb to the top, going at a reasonable pace. Obviously, the mountains are just 6 days of hell, of sort of big days. And that's if everything goes right. I had one mountain last year in the Andes that went really spectacularly wrong. I got frostbite on two fingers, which luckily has healed. As you can see now, they're perfectly back to normal. But, you know, that ended up being like a 21-hour day. So.
Right. Let's deal with the ice climbing first, and then we'll talk about the frostbite in a minute. So you stand at the bottom of this frozen waterfall and you look up. What's the thought process? How the fuck am I getting up this thing?
I think the key for me is I shut everything out and I just literally focus and like slow my breathing, slow my heart rate down. Don't let the psychology of what I'm about to do get into it, because what I find that happens to me, at least anyway, is it shoots my heart rate up and then I become really inefficient, and that's when I'm going to fall. That's where I'm going to make a mistake. So I calm everything right down and then I just rely on a process, really, where I say every axe placement has to be a 7 or above, and every crampon placement has to be a 7 or above. So if you have like 1 to 10, 1 is like super shitty and 10 is like a bomber, you can hang off it, not a problem. It needs to be at least a 7 before I move off. And if I can't get a 7, I keep trying somewhere else until I can get it. Because ultimately, if you get each axe placement in perfectly, if you get each crampon placement on your feet in perfectly, it's like up you go, slowly but surely, not a problem. Keeping a mindset as well, because the problem with ice climbing, because you're holding these ice axes like this, your forearms will get really pumped because they're in the same grip position for the entire time. And you can't really like sit there and like shake everything out and stretch. Like, you've got to kind of take those moments to sort of loosen your grip and whatever. So that's my mindset. I think for ice climbing, triceps are so important. They are probably like one of the most important muscles, because this motion here, I don't know if you can see it, but that motion is just basically triceps.
Okay. So then I guess my question of all this is why?
That honestly is a great question. Like why do you do what you do here? And you know, obviously there's the death aspect of things, which I prefer to live longer personally.
Still,
but
alive,
it's fine.
Dave. I'm
it's
still
fine.
Alive
like,
right
you do
now.
You.
Well, if you did Kilimanjaro when you were 21, you've been doing it for at least a year. So, like, why do you continue? Why do you continually do it? Like, why do you continually go back?
It's a really good question. Yeah. I don't know, to be honest. When I'm sitting in a tent on a mountain, for example, I'm like, why the hell am I doing this? What is wrong with me? This is so miserable. I hate this. This is hell. And then I'll go back again and again and again. And I think I saw something that, like, I think there's something in athletes where you get a lot of enjoyment from the overcoming of suffering. And whether that's weightlifting, whether that's endurance events, whatever it is, I think you get that feeling of success, that feeling of accomplishment is almost linked to the amount of suffering you've had to endure and the amount of sacrifice you've had to put into it in order to get there. And so I think for me, something that didn't have any element of that would never satisfy me.
Okay, fair. Do you find that the degree of suffering and shittiness at the time helps you deal with everything else in life? Like, if you just think back, well, at least I'm not sitting in the fucking tent in the freezing cold half that point.
It makes you tougher. And I think it definitely gives you a perspective of like, I'm in this and I can just keep being in this and keep dealing with it, you know? So when you're in horrible situations in your life or in business or whatever, you can kind of say, you know, instead of worrying about all these different outcomes, you're just in the moment. How do I deal with it? Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And I think the other thing that I love about the mountaineering and climbing community is the camaraderie is amazing. Like, you climb with people from all over the world. I've climbed with Kazakhs, I've climbed with Chinese people, all these different people. You form this amazing bond with these people because your lives are temporarily kind of tied together.
Do you think the, you know, you mentioned transferable skills into real life. I mean, do you think being able to push yourself, I think, in a dangerous situation, push your body mentally, physically, everything else, also prepares you for handling stress and situations in real life? Like, they're not comparable to me, right? It's like, is the stuff I'm really worried about day to day in my job or my business as stressful as climbing a mountain? Probably not, right? So, like, you know, the transferable skills there, I think you'd have a cooler head and being able to really navigate what I think normal folks in society that don't do risky situations. Like, I know for me, like when I went to Iraq and I, you know, was in some very, you know, bad situations, my perspective of life was very different. Like, I don't look at a lot of the outrage that occurs from a lot of the folks in today's society you know, as the same way, it doesn't bother me as much as it does. I'm not saying that that's right or wrong. I'm just saying my perspective of life is very different because I've had so many close calls, or I've done things that have been very difficult in nature in life that others haven't experienced. So my temperance is very level set until, you know, something actually happens that requires me to, you know, be near death or something to that effect. Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, am I making any sense? Situations as well. You learn like, okay, what are my options? Because panic doesn't help anything. It's not going to solve a single thing that I'm in. If I'm on a mountain, and so when I was on this mountain last year, I got knocked out by falling ice. I was hanging in my harness. I genuinely thought there was a chance this was going to be like curtains for me. And it's amazing how pragmatic you are in that situation, because you're just like, okay, what are my options? I can try and climb up. I can try and do this. I can try and do that. These are my options. What's the best one to go for in this situation? And I think when you're in those situations, you have to make decisions by yourself, and you have to make them based off the options that you have. And one thing that I think we're really terrible at generally in our everyday lives is we depend upon everybody else, and we sort of crowdsource our decision making because we're not confident enough to do it ourselves. And we're panicking and we're worrying and we're blowing things out of proportion and not seeing it for what it is. And I think being in those situations, like Dave was just saying with being in the military, you know, it really teaches you to take it back down and strip it right out and go, right, what are my options? What's happened? Let's triage the situation. Let's work through this in a kind of really logical way. So I think that's really transferable from mountaineering.
So people who struggle with the what do you want for dinner question, what do you want for dinner question, need to go and spend some time up a mountain until they work out like how to actually make a tough decision.
Run, like workshops. No one will show up.
But Dave definitely won't, because he knows he's going to waste some muscle mass.
In Mongolia, that's his Christmas present this year.
That's right. So the Mongolian beef has always been amazing. Mongolia, so it has to be something. As I discovered,
that is actually from Taiwan, and they named it Mongolian beef, but it's got, as I discovered, absolutely nothing to do with Mongolia at all.
Oh, I had no idea. So all this time I've been eating Mongolian beef, thinking I'm like a true Mongolian.
When you go there, it will all become clear in December, there, right? Dave, when you turn up there.
So, favorite place to climb? Like, favorite place that you've been?
The Andes, South America. Because the South Americans are just epic into and of themselves. Like, it's just chaos. It's chaos from the moment you get to the airport to the moment you leave. Nothing seems to work. Everything's just all over the place. It's just absolutely nuts. But the mountains are spectacular. Last year, I went actually to the Amazon rainforest afterwards for some sort of R&R. And that was actually a harder environment than any mountain I've ever climbed. It was, if you've not been to the Amazon rainforest, it's an experience.
I have not. Worth go after we go to Mongolia.
There you go, R&R in the Amazon. Pop there over. You go. Expensive, but doable.
Right. Anytime I'm talking to you specifically, I'm like, I feel like I enjoy training quite a lot, but I'm like, I feel like I haven't done anything. I'm like, I'm just fucking in the gym lifting some dumbbells, I really want to do something else.
I just pick up heavy stuff and put it down.
Yeah,
like, you know, and then there's like Lisa's climbing mountains. You know, it's like, I feel like I need to just climb a mountain so that I can be like, yeah, so I climbed a mountain too. And
we will set it up.
We can set it up.
No.
Is there any warm mountains? You know, like that are not cold? Okay. No? All right.
Worth surely a shot. It's just an altitude thing. Like, surely if you get past a certain altitude, it's just fucking cold.
But you
and that's
have good jackets. So it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as long as I can stay, like, kind of warm, I'll be okay. I'm not, like, that big of a baby. I just don't like being cold personally. So, yeah.
It's doable.
Okay.
I think for me, I think about like being up it and having to make the decisions. It's like you cannot take yourself out of the situation. Do you know what I mean? Like you're forced to deal with the situation.
And there's a lot of that in climbing, full stop. You can't be climbing up a waterfall that's frozen and be thinking about what some idiot said to you on social media. Like, it doesn't enter your mind. Your mind's almost completely clear.
I think that we can all have the idiots on social media conversation. That's something I think that we can all relate to for sure.
I just, you know, it's funny because I get stuff, you know, people sending me stuff. I'm like, I have no idea what's going on. Like, did you see this? I'm like, no. Does it look like I have time to sit there and talk crap on social media all the time? I'm busy doing other things, you know, like, I don't know. People are in their own ecosystem, their own worlds, which is why I think things like what you do, you know, experiencing other countries, for example, you travel all the time. Like I always see you're like in a completely different, you know, place. Mm-hmm. And I think you get a different perspective on countries and lives and way of living and, you know, things that yeah. people actually deal with on a day-to-day basis, that it makes, you know, like everything that we deal with here looks so myopic in every way. You know, you see the poverty levels. I was just in Honduras, Roatan. And I mean, you just, you know, the eastern side of the island, it's kind of interesting. Like the western side of the island was able to kind of like commercialize and become more on, they're both competing, I guess, in fishing, commercialized fishing, and they were sending to the United States. But the East was like running their people like 14 hours a day scuba diving. People were just dying all the time. So the U.S. banned any fishing from Honduras, from Roatan. And so they went into tourism, and the West adopted tourism. The East didn't. You just see like the stark differences, because they're like two separate kind of like economies mm-hmm. / like politics. And you go to like the West side, and there's roads, everything's having a great time. Everybody's employed. You go to the east side, and it's just, you know, like straight poverty. We're talking like these towns where you have,
oh my god,
you know, people living in straw houses and, you know, not clean drinking water and, you know, all other stuff. And you're like, hey, you know, I got this cell phone and I got this amazing, you know, car, and, you know, and yet we're still fighting about, you know, the you know, most minute things, it seems like, when these people can barely, you know, get food and water. So, you know, I think, you know, the threshold and the levels of that we have as far as stress also mm-hmm. directly applies to us in business as well. You know, obviously you've been highly successful in what you do and being an entrepreneur and everything else. You know, I think that perspective allows us to be calm and say, well, hey, I can take yeah. risks, and I know how to manage yeah, those yeah. risks, because it's not climbing a mountain, right? You know, it's like everything else seems so much smaller
not,
in nature.
It's not life or death.
It's not life or death, right? And I think that mindset is something that can't be stated enough, because most folks that don't experience some really significant challenges in their life, whether, you know, it's a hobby or a sport, or, you know, an athlete, for example, having to push themselves to a certain level, or somebody that's served in the military, has been to war. You know, they're all different variations of that. But I mean, I think it's huge. You see a lot of successful folks that are the ones that push themselves in different directions, or have some pretty crazy
really
experiences throughout their life.
The one thing you can guarantee about anyone who's really into fitness is that they have self-discipline. Like 100%. That's, you know, they may not be a nice person. It's not judging who they are, but they will definitely be disciplined.
That's
because
like, yeah.
there is no way you can be fit or be able to lift what you're lifting or whatever you're doing and not have the ability to say, no, I'm not going to sit on my couch. I'm going to go and take my ass to the gym. So I think that also really helps in a lot of things you do, because you have this ability to go, I really want to do nothing. I really want to take the easy route, but I'm not going to. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do the route that I know I need to do. And I think that really helps you.
Yep.
Agree. I think that the discipline piece, and I often go back to like me before I trained versus me now, two completely different people, but that discipline piece of like knowing that I'm actually in control. Like if I decide to yeah. do something or not to do something, it's going to either drive me closer to what I'm trying to achieve or further away. And that to me is the biggest transferable skill. It's like, okay, yes, I learned it through nutrition and going to the gym, but in terms of like work, especially whenever you're self-employed, like could I get up every day and be like, I'm just going to fucking sit and play the PlayStation all day? Like, yes, absolutely. But it's not going to drive me closer to what the goal is. It's having the discipline to be like, no, I'm going to sit in here. And as we said, when you come on, talk to people on the internet all day, but having the discipline to do it and actually get up and do the work.
Definitely the key, the biggest benefit almost, I think, from training, I think, is that ability, that self-discipline.
Agree. And I think that teaching that is difficult, and I think you just need to find the thing. And I actually, I've said this before, I think I said this initially to you, Dave, whenever we first started, because obviously initially whenever we started, yes, you hadn't had success in terms of like your training and your fitness, but you had mm-hmm. the discipline to build the company. Like you had the mindset to build the company. So it's like trying to find the thing that someone could be disciplined to pull them out to transfer it then back into the training aspect.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the way that you build a company, the way that you are successful in your career, the way that you get into training. I think they're all interrelated, right? You kind of fixate on them, make it your hobby slash, you know, your goal, and you shoot for that goal, right? Whatever that is. And, you know, I think the successful folks that are doing mountain climbing or sport or an athlete or fitness or whatever, they have that drive to better themselves. And it's a further outlook, knowing that you're not going to get the reward instantaneously. You're not going to get the reward today. You're not going to get the reward tomorrow. And that this is going to be, you know, kind of an ongoing forever thing that you have to do. You know, same thing when I started the business, it's like, you know, hey, I have no idea what I'm doing, but you know, I know that I'm going to figure it out, and it's going to be my drive, my passion, my hobby, and whatever I need to do, whatever person I need to be, whatever skill I need to figure out, I'm going to have to figure that out, because that's what's required of me to be successful in that area. There is no, well, I don't know what to do, so I can't do it. It's, well, I'm going to have to figure out how to do it so that I can do it, right? And I think that's the big difference that, you know, a lot of folks that are successful entrepreneurs have, is they don't look at the risks. For lack of a better term, they don't look at like, hey, I can fail at this, or hey, you know, I'm not going to be successful. They kind of push that down and they say, well, I'm going to have risks, and yeah, it's possible I'm not gonna be successful, but there's a good chance I'm going to be successful, and there's a good chance I can manage these risks. So I'm just going to go and figure it out. Right. And I think that mindset is very different than what a lot of folks typically have, or maybe they do have it. They just have enough confidence in themselves to be able to push themselves forward. And it's always like, you know, for cybersecurity, I always get asked, like, people coming in, like, they're like, whoa, cybersecurity is such this, so many different topics, so many different things. How do I even go into it? I'm like, you just go into it and you learn. Like, that's the best advice I can give you. Like, you don't need to know everything. You're not going to ever know everything, but find something you like doing and just go all in on it and just keep researching and obsess about it, fixate about it. I mean, you know, I remember coding on airplanes, coding when I was about to go to sleep, coding when I'd wake up, you know, writing exploits, you know, 40 hours a day. Sometimes I wouldn't even sleep for 2 days because I was like coding stuff, right? You know, not the healthiest thing, but you know, at the same time, it was what I was fixated on because I wanted to be successful at that. I wanted to learn that new trade. And I always go back to that one exploit that I wrote in SL Mail. It was like a data execution prevention bypass. And there was a FRAC article that was like experimental on potential ways of getting around data execution prevention, but it was very light on any type of technical details. So like, I had to figure it out. And I remember when I first went at it, I'm like, I'm too stupid to know this. My brain's basically like, you're too stupid to know how to do this, right? But I'm like, you know, screw you, brain. I'm not too stupid. I'm going to figure this out. If I have to smash a Windows machine with a hammer, I'm going to figure this thing out no matter what. Okay. And I spent like a week, and, you know, and I built up little nuggets of knowledge here and there. And the thing that really was not obtainable that, you know, a week prior, now was starting to make a little bit of sense. And then I started piecing together the puzzles. And then eventually I figured it out. And I remember because I was sleeping and I couldn't go to sleep because like my mind's just going like da 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 da. And finally, when I fell asleep, I woke up at like 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, aha, I know how to do it now. And I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning, went downstairs and I coded and it worked. And so, you know, it's like those types of things you have to overcome, you know, in your mind to go and do these. And there's no difference in fitness. It's like, hey, I can't do this. Well, if you say you can't do that, you're probably not going to do it. But if I say, hey, I can do this, or I'm going to go as hard as I possibly can, and I'm not going to let myself fail, it's different, right? You know, mentality, mindset, you know, how you look at things, your outlook in life and forward thinking, I think is very necessary in any of these things that we're talking about.
She really wanted to be able to do pull-ups. And she was like, you know, that's what I really want. I was like, cool, that's a good goal to have. Good for you. What are you doing at the moment upper body-wise? Oh, I don't do any upper body training. And I'm like, okay, well, it's not going to magically manifest and one day you can just be like, oh, look, I can rep out 10 sets of 10 pull-ups. It's very unlikely that's going to happen. You need to actually be doing things to start building that upper body and slowly getting into it. And she's like, oh, well, I went to the gym and I did 2 weeks of stuff and then I still couldn't do them. So I gave up. Maybe I'm just not built for it. And I'm like, someone said to me at the very, very many years ago, at the beginning of my training, they said, you can't really achieve anything in a month, but you can achieve a lot in a year. And it's something that's always stuck with me, that like, if you think this is like an Amazon Prime type of relationship where you can click buy and then you get it, forget it. You're going to fail. It's going to be a disaster. But if you stick with it for a year and you're consistent, you can achieve absolutely amazing things in 12 months. In a month, no. But in 12 months, yes. And I think our mindset in society has been very much, I want a quick fix. What's the quick fix for this? And in like anything that's got any real value, fitness, business, career, there is no quick fix. what you put in is what you get out.
I think that that's something that I struggle with, because whenever I'm having a conversation, discovery call with a client, I'm like, yeah, it's going to be a year-long commitment. And they've been bombarded with on socials or other coaches they spoke to, it's like, well, it's 6 weeks this and it's 6 weeks that. And I'm like,
four week keto fast.
Yeah, you know, yeah. And I'm like, that's cool. I mean, you can go and do that, but you're not going to get the results that you need. But it is, I think where I see people struggle with the most is not the thing that they were doing, whether it's the diet or the training program or whatever. It's just not having a long enough time horizon to actually get to where they needed to be. Mm-hmm. Like, just doing something for long enough is going to be better than chopping and changing between different things.
Yeah. And a good example, you'd mentioned the pull-up situation, brought me back to a memory. When I first joined the Marines, they had this thing where if you couldn't pass what they call the IST, or the initial strength test, you went into what's called the PCP, or the physical conditioning platoon, which is also named the pork chop platoon. And so I was, you know, I was a bit overweight then, obviously. And, you know, I wasn't physically fit and I couldn't complete the IST, the initial strength test, which was, I believe was three pull-ups. You had to do three pull-ups minimally. And you had to run like a mile and a half in a certain amount of time, and the crunches I was able to do. So, you know, I remember like for the longest time, you know, I'm trying pull-ups, I can do the run, I can do the crunches, but I couldn't do the pull-ups. And let me rephrase that. I couldn't do the run or the pull-ups. Okay. And so there was one day where in my mind, I'm like, I'm going to do this. And I remember the drill instructor sitting there, and I went up and I knocked out six. I went from zero to six. And, you know, like it literally was like a flip of a switch in my mind. And I don't know what happened, but I went from zero pull-ups to six. And granted, I was getting yelled at all the time and screamed, and I was like demotivated. And so I felt like I couldn't even do it. I was never going to be able to accomplish it. One day I said, I'm like, I need to get out of this pork chop platoon. You know, I've been here for like 2 months, and this is time for me to get the hell out of here. So then I did it, and I did six of them. And then the drill instructor, he's like, I'm going to run with you, Kennedy, and we're going to complete this mile and a half, because I never had completed the mile and a half in time. And let's just say a mile and a half was, I want to say it was like 12 minutes. I can't remember the exact time, right? But I did it in like eight, you know? So it was like, you know, the mindset had switched. Now I had motivation to get out of that damn place. I had already done the six. I already passed that. I was not going to let myself not complete the run and have to go back one more day to go and do it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's crazy what we can tell ourselves. You know, obviously training practice, consistently doing the same thing over and over again is how we get better at things. It's how our mind works, how our brain works.
I think they've shown that as well, haven't they? Like, I was watching like a whole load of things where they were talking about studies where they've looked at like the point at which your brain says you have to put the barbell down or whatever, like you're done, like that's your last rep, but that's nowhere near your last rep. Like, you've got a good few more in the actual muscle, but your brain is working against you. I can't remember what phrase you used earlier, Dave, about like, screw you, brain, or something. It's basically that. Screw you, brain.
Yeah. Screw you. I'm smart enough. I can do this. I'm not listening to you anymore. You're not charging me.
Like, it comes back to, even we've seen it time and time again at the in-person events, and it's one thing that I enjoy the most, not like from the, there's a clip from the after movie that we'll see soon enough where Dave's like so excited because he can't wait to put everybody through leg day, and he's just so hyped for it. But it's that, like you said, whenever you're in that place of, you see the person's like ready to stop, and either I'm in your ear or Dave or one of the coaches is in your ear, and you just say five more, and you can see they're like, fuck, yeah, in their face, but then they do them. I'm like, well, I mean, there you go. You just fucking did it. Like, it's there. You just, it's that mental side to know that you can actually do it. So, Lisa, what's next?
In the Andes, I don't know. Lots of more different crazy stuff. I need to plan something crazy for the winter as well. I don't know. No, Dave's going.
Not Mongolia.
And I am
going to
get a
Tick
live
box,
stream through,
back there,
because that would just be a thing of beauty.
And we're going to enjoy some traditional Mongolian beef, right?
It won't be beef. And it won't be enjoy. But yes, you will have both of those things. It's more of the same, I think. I've got
just more of the same.
Lots of big goals, but they require lots of pieces in the puzzle to be put together, really. There's some big things I really want to achieve, but they require a little bit of patience and, you know, maybe a couple of years of more difficult mountains, more dangerous mountains, to build a bit more experience to be able to go and do them. Because like everything, if you really just want to go after it and go and have a shot, unfortunately the people who do that tend to die. So
and we don't want that. We would like you to come back on the podcast.
You're still here. You're doing it the right way.
So, yeah, I need to come back in 2 years time, so I've got to survive at least two more years.
Okay, yeah, cool. Well, we might have you back sooner than that.
But yeah, I think I'm definitely coming to lifting camp. I'm trying to convince Ben to do lifting camp in the UAE, which...
I've already put the feelers out, so we're working on it. In fact, I'll say this, and we can wrap up after that. It's not that you're... Maybe it says something about your personality that we don't know, or maybe you do know. You don't want to come to lifting camp. You want to create your own specific lifting camp pathway across the world.
And I want to vomit, and I want to cry. If I get both of those things, I'll be like super happy. I don't even really care about the gains. I just want to basically be tortured in another country and then come away going, that was an amazing, profound experience.
That was great. When are we doing it again?
This sounds amazing.
Cool. Right. Well, thanks for joining us. That went by real quick. I always find it. Yeah, it did. But yeah, thanks for joining us.
It was great to see you, seriously, and always impressed with what you're able to do and how you do things. The feats that you've done are definitely second to none in our industry, and really cool to hear the stories and mindsets, because I think it's a lot similar to what folks could be really pushing themselves to, not obviously climbing mountains unless you really want to and your experience and everything else, but the aspect around how you can kind of frame your mind to do things that you never thought possible and going through situations like oxygen deprivation and still pushing yourself through. And those are all things that, we can definitely be a lot better at in our careers, our profession, our jobs, just by having that type of mindset. So I always appreciate your perspective on things.
That's what we've learned.
Screw you, brain. Cool. Right. Thanks. We'll see you in a bit.
Thanks.